Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, where we were joined by the legendary, by the superstar, by the all-round top guy, who is Nish Kumar. And now anyone in the UK will know all about Nish. He is very often seen on our televisions, and now he is on our podcast. If you are not from the UK and you're not familiar with Nish's work, then after listening to this episode, you will surely want to go to YouTube. If you search for Nish Kumar, you will find a full recording of one of his shows, and it's definitely worth checking out his stand-up because it is brilliant. If you are in the UK or in Ireland, then maybe you want to go and see Nish live. You can go to nishkumar.co.uk and you will find all the dates of his tour there. He is doing a work in progress at the Edinburgh Festival, and then he is going on the road in September, and he is very likely to be at a town near you. If you'd like to know more about us, then go to Patreon. Patreon.com/clubfish is a place to go. You can sign up there for free and get lots of little bits and pieces, or you can sign up to one of our tiers and get even more. In fact, if you go to the Plenty More Fish tier this week, you will get an extra long episode of this show. In fact, you always get one of those, but this show is about 20 minutes longer than the actual episode. And that is because Nish Kumar is so knowledgeable about so many different things, especially the subjects we talked about today, and so there are so many extra bits, extra facts, extra jokes, extra anecdotes, and it is all in there. But if you don't want to do that, do not worry, just sit down and listen to this week's episode with Nish Kumar. On with the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Anna Tuschinski, and I'm sitting here with James Harkin, Andrew Hunter-Murray, and Nish Kumar. And we have gathered here today with our four favourite facts from the last 7 days. In no particular order, here we go, starting with you, Nish.
My favourite fact that I've gathered in the last 7 days is, after James Cameron was fired from the film Piranha 2, he broke into the studios multiple times in the dead of night to improve the edit.
What a hero.
Yeah, he cares that much about the craft.
Also, it's so funny to think of the word craft associated with the film Piranha 2.
Yeah.
It's not Bong Joon-ho saying to me, this is cinema. It doesn't quite feel like that. To give him his due, I think that is part of the reason why he is, I think he occupies, I think about maybe 4 or 5 of the 20 most profitable films of all time. Maybe not profitable, but most financially successful films of all time. Because the sort of common thread of all of his movies is this sort of almost operatic grandeur being applied to very sort of mainstream conventional films. They get elevated by his sociopathic commitment.
So hang on, is Piranha 2 in the top 20 grossing films of all time? Because I haven't seen, it's one of the Cameron oeuvre that I haven't seen.
Yeah, right.
I don't think it's in the top 2 of the Piranha films.
I think all of the avatars are floating around in there.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
And
certainly Titanic.
I think it's cheating when your sequels count. Which people do it with Avatar. They count Avatar and its sequel. It's like, lump them together. Because, if you know this one's grossed a lot, then the next one's probably...
But then it'll just be Avatar Marvel. And then I think, it'll have to be,
Police Academy.
Police Academy. Yeah, I think that's it.
What I found mad about reading about Piranha 2 is how, like you say, it's surprising that James Cameron cared enough to break into the edit suite, but how seriously they all took it. Because you think, surely if you're working on these films in any role, you know you're making a joke, don't
well,
you?
Well, no, Piranha 1 was huge, right? Yeah. It was a big movie that did really well.
That was Joe Dante of Gremlins fame,
okay.
I believe. And then Piranha 2, Cameron had been hired to work on it. And we should say it's his first ever film he'd worked on as a director.
Yes.
And he was hired to work on it by the producer. And it sounds like it was a nightmare to work on.
Yeah.
And he was fired quite quickly.
Yeah.
They filmed in Jamaica the outdoor piranha bits, and then they actually moved to Rome for the indoor bits. And he was fired at the end of the Jamaica bit, so that's why he was breaking in. Like, he was breaking in because he'd been fired from the project, but his name was still on it, and he thought, this is so bad, I can't let it go out like it is.
The thing was, there was this guy called Ovidio Asinitis.
Yeah.
It's like to video, it's almost his first
name. Yeah. But,
he really wanted to be the director, but because he was half Italian and half Egyptian, the American movie industry wouldn't let him be director. So he had to bring someone in. And his idea was, we'll bring a new person in. They won't do anything, but I'll be the real director.
Yeah.
But then he brought James Cameron in. Who kind of took it a bit seriously.
So unlucky. One of the most dementedly single-minded people in cinema.
Because as far as he knew, he was a 28-year-old nobody, right? Yes. He's like, good, I'm getting an intern on. And he was obsessive.
Was he like, is he a Roger Corman guy? I think he comes out of that sort of, Cameron comes out of that stable where they were just sort of all being trained to do everything in film and then sort of thrown out into the wider world. A couple of years ago, I went to the Academy Museum in LA, where they sort of have various bits of film ephemera. They have his concept sketches for The Terminator. And when you look at the concept sketch of The Terminator, you go, that looks exactly like the film. That it's exactly like the film. And so the thing that you, my main takeaway from looking at those sketches was, this is a guy with a vision. And this is a man who I imagine will walk through and over anything he has to.
Yeah. He does come across as that.
Yeah, he's the Terminator.
Yeah, he is the Terminator. Oh, he is the Terminator.
In a way.
He thought he was the hero of that, but he was the villain.
He was telling you about Terminator 2, but that's another matter.
I watched those movies so many hundreds of times when I was palpably too young to be watching them. Because my parents... My parents would stop us from watching things like... I remember my parents saw Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the worst thing they could possibly have said to me, because I said, how was it? And they said, really brilliant. And I said, oh, great, can I watch it? They went, no. Well, why would you say that the movie was good? I was like 10 years old. I was like, why would you say the film is good? But they saw the Terminator box. They thought, yeah, it's robots and lasers. Who cares? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, meanwhile, then they sort of walk in the room and a guy's using a fountain pen to dig his eye out. I do think my mum at that point was like, oh, okay, I think we might have misread the situation here.
I mean, some people still aren't really sure what Terminator's about.
Look, I was impressed by what I learned.
I'm just going to get...
Come on.
I'm just going to get a message out on my phone that we received from Anna.
What's embarrassing about this is my first serious relationship was with a guy. It was for 3 years and he was obsessed with the Terminator films.
Anna, please, we need to read out the evidence before we have your response to it. Anna Tuschinski. The concept of Terminator is absolutely mental. I just thought it was about a metal bloke killing people. Which at the most basic level, it is.
Nothing you've said there is incorrect.
I suppose it had more layers than I expected.
Yeah, you've not disproved your initial assumption.
No.
Metal bloke is actually sort of perfect description of Terminator. There was a real, between Terminator and RoboCop, my childhood was defined by metal blokes.
Yes. We have Piranha 2 to thank for Terminator. Mm. I didn't know about this. So basically, Piranha 2 happens and it's a disaster. He develops a high fever. He's in Rome.
Yes.
So at this stage, he's not being paid anymore. Is that right?
No, he's off the clock.
Yeah, this is the story. This is the crazy inception of Terminator.
He goes into, he's hospitalized with this really high fever. But while he's in hospital, probably because of the Piranha 2 stressful and sacking and all that, he has this vision of a skeleton robot coming out of a fire.
A metal bloke.
And crawling. Because that's the only bit of Terminator I've seen. Is you know, that scene where he's crawling at the top of him. I don't know what's happened to the bottom, but he's crawling towards that woman. I couldn't work out whose side I was on. So in the Piranha 2 debacle, Asinitis sounded like a bit of a douchebag as well, the producer. Yeah. But I mean, he did talk about James Cameron, and like, he is obviously a massive control freak. And he said, so Asinitis, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but Asinitis, that's better.
Yeah, that was much better.
He said,
what in the name of Super Mario Brothers was that?
He did say Cameron was very arrogant, and he said at one point he just came out of his office and he saw his crew, the entire crew, and set way out in the distance, out to sea on a bunch of boats when they were meant to be on the beach filming. And the first assistant director was fully clothed, swimming towards the shore. He got to the shore and he pulled himself up onto the beach and he shouted at Antonitis, "That guy is a maniac," as in James Cameron's a maniac. "I'm out of here." And James so Antonitis is like, "What's he done? Why are you all out at sea?" And he was like, "James Cameron saw the perfect shaped cloud and he knew we had to film it." So the entire crew and set is now on a series of boats out at sea chasing a cloud.
I'm just following, chasing after
the
it.
Whole thing with clouds is like, oh, that one looks like a giraffe. Oh, it doesn't look like a giraffe anymore. Yeah. They change shapes.
Good point.
That's so weird.
And listen, maybe this is, you know, and I say this as a huge fan of his work, and maybe this is a bit of snobbery on my part, but when you hear stories like that about Kubrick or Kurosawa, you're like, yeah, of course, you have to get the perfect thing. This, what you're making is this kind of, this is a sort of work of art. When you hear about Piranha 2, you think, have you lost your fucking mind? the other thing that I always like to bring to this is actually something that James Acaster introduced me to, and it's a real obsession of his. So in the book, The Futurist, The Life and Films of James Cameron by Rebecca Keegan, she narrates a story about the shoot of Aliens. And Aliens shot at Pinewood, and I think Star Wars shot at Elstree. Mm-hmm. And both of those films have the kind of same experience, which is an American director doing a science fiction film that a British crew of, you know, pretty hardened union guys cannot have any respect for whatsoever. And like they used to call, when they were shooting Star Wars, they used to just refer to the Chewbacca costume as the dog. And so on the final day of shooting Aliens, so this, according to Rebecca King's book, this is what James Cameron says to the crew. "This has been a long and difficult shoot, fraught by many problems. But the one thing that kept me going through it all was the certain knowledge that one day I would drive out of the gates of Pinewood and never come back here, and that you sorry bastards would all still be here." That's it's like rousing end of shoot speech.
That's what Dan Schreiber says to us every episode of the show.
Before he goes on holiday.
I thought there were huge problems with tea breaks.
Is
this an Aliens? Star Wars and Aliens alike. Basically, the crew know very clearly when they get a tea break. Yeah, you got a union tea break. And Cameron is there being an auteur and saying, "But we need to film for 28 hours to get this perfect shot in this perfect way." And they're saying, "Well, we can't. We're going for our tea break." Yeah. I love it.
I read that he made movie posters, Cameron, before he got into directing. And that he basically didn't watch the films because they're all terrible, so he just got the name of it and he would just make something that he thought looked cool and then send it in. It meant that he was really a control freak with the posters for his movies. And so with Aliens, some guy showed him what he thought the poster should be for Aliens, and he said, "Honestly, if I have the choice between that piece of shit and an all-black frame, I'll go with the all-black frame." And this guy obviously wasn't really listening, and he then went to his designers and went, "He wants an all-black frame." And then we have the iconic sort of, it just says the word Aliens, doesn't it?
I think the strapline is, "This time it's war." Because the idea is, in the first film there's one alien, in the second film there are thousands. And it's kind of a bit of a Vietnam analogy, you know, disastrous, overconfident American Marines heading into a war that runs out of control. But I think supposedly he invented the "this time it's blah."
Really?
Was that before "this time it's personal"? I know that was Jaws, wasn't it? Jaws 2.
Jaws 2, "this time it's personal"?
Was that not first Jaws?
Like, first Jaws, it's business. This is just business.
Third Jaws, "this time it's pleasure." And it's about the shark and Brody going on a lad's holiday.
Do you know what? We have Jaws to thank for the Terminator.
Oh, really?
Because we have Piranha 2 to thank for Terminator.
Yeah.
Piranha 1 to thank for Piranha 2. And Piranha 1 only existed because it was like a rip-off of Jaws.
Yeah.
And Steven Spielberg went to watch it, and they were going to sue and say, "You can't make this." And Steven Spielberg enjoyed it so much, he was like, "Oh, don't sue them. This is really great."
And is that why? Because then Joe Dante then...
Yeah,
Spielberg produced Gremlins.
Yeah, so they worked together afterwards.
Wow, really? That's amazing. That's really cool.
We have so many things I haven't seen to thank for so many other things I haven't seen. I'm really grateful today.
What were you doing? We're the same age. What were you doing?
I didn't know. I was going out.
Yeah.
Oh.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
We should move on to fact number 2. That's my fact. My fact this week is that the inventor of stand-up comedy was known as the man who talks with string.
What?
Because he was never, well, I will tell you what, because he was never seen anywhere without his lucky string.
Consider yourself admonished.
That's what.
The fact that I've said what, as if you weren't going to clarify. Yeah. So that was just going to be the end of the discussion.
Moving on, fact number 3. Yeah.
The inventor of sound of comedy was known as the man of string. Okay, anyway, who's got a fact about Roger Corman?
I just also want to clarify, he's not a man of string, he's not made of string, he just carries string.
So we've got metal men, we've got string men.
Metal men, sure.
So the man who talks with string, as in he talks but he's holding string?
Exactly, yes. This is a guy called Charlie Case. He tends to be referred to as the person who invented stand-up comedy, although obviously there's a lot of facets to stand up, so lots of rivals in that claim. But he was born in 1858, so it was late 19th century. And this is in a book called The Legacy of the Wisecrack, which I mentioned because it had some other interesting bits in it. And he was basically the first person who took to the stage, as it says, with the explicit purpose of telling jokes to make people laugh. No props, no costume, they say, although at the time almost everyone did blackface on stage, and he did do that. So, okay.
But I read he was mixed. He was mixed race, right?
Well, it's very unclear.
It's not sure. Yeah, the records are a bit.
His obituaries say they think he was mixed race, but black people and white people at the time would go in blackface. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And black performers blacked up sort of as way into the industry.
Yeah,
because of the white performers.
Yeah,
is that it?
Yeah. Very strange. And we really don't know with him. I think he probably was, but people didn't mention it in his life. And then in his obituaries, everyone was like, he had a black parent, and.
Right. Yeah.
And he had this string that he always carried on stage, and he fiddled with it constantly. Couldn't be without it. A couple of times he forgot it, and if no replacement could be found, he just fully, you know, broke down. He said, I might as well be without my hand. And he explained it. He said when he first went into business, he wore a pair of black gloves, and he would fiddle with them and toy with one of them, pick at the fingers, and eventually, a bit like when you give a baby a rag, and then after 5 years, you realise it's just a string. He'd picked at his gloves so much that they just turned
really?
Into a string.
Like a blanket rather than a rag, usually.
A blanket?
Why are you giving your baby a rag?
Give your baby a rag. No, you know what is? This is, we need to start toughening up the younger generation. They're
give
too
him a rag.
Woke. Give them a rag. Yeah.
But there, wow. There you go. So he needed that. And he, you know, he really did. He couldn't be without it.
That's amazing. And I guess, like, it's to do something with your hands, right? Like,
I think so, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Really? I don't think I've never heard this man's name in my life before. That's fascinating.
He
That's
is not
really
famous.
It makes sense that it's in that period because here sometimes we're still referred to as the turn, and I never really understood why that was. And it's because in vaudeville shows, when they were turning the set from, you know, the acrobat to the sort of marching band, they would put the curtain down and somebody would come out and tell jokes to stop the audience from getting bored.
Oh.
And so they were turning the set behind the curtain.
Huh,
so the person telling the jokes is still sometimes referred to as the turn or front of curtain entertainers.
Oh, really?
And it's because...
I love that.
Yeah, it's like, it's, you know, particularly like a lot of the like old school guys who do lots of gigs at like Blackpool or sort of Butlins will call us front of the curtain. And we were basically just there to stop the audience from
getting
away.
Yeah. Sometimes, obviously, had the opposite effect. It really depends on who you employ.
Oh, listen, I'd have really struggled in the vaudeville years. I'd have been a real struggle. Half the audience have left and they are asking for their money back. They thought they were going to see elephants and instead they've seen a man yelling about David Lloyd George.
Yeah.
He was really sticking it to Gladstone back then.
Nish, we need to clear the stage at the end of the show. So if you could come on then, clear the auditorium.
So this guy, was he British?
Oh my gosh.
Charlie Case. I think he was American.
American, okay.
I think he was American.
They were also, they had the same sort of tradition of vaudeville. And when you do stand up in a Matcham theatre, like the Victorians, say what you will about them, they knew two things. Colonizing my ancestors and building theatres. And when you do stuff in a Matcham theatre, you understand, this is what this is built for. because the acoustics are so unbelievably good. A 1,000-seat room has the same sonic dynamics as a 300-seat basement.
Yeah.
Or to 150-seat
basement. It's pretty extraordinary.
It's unbelievable. You know, I'm thinking of something like the Hackney Empire has loads of stand-up. They have a pantomime every year. And then Robin just did a gig there. Like when her last album came out, I think she did a special sort of small gig. And so you're like, there's very few places where you can put like Robin, a pantomime, and me.
Can I just ask Andy which Robin you thought referring to?
Initially, I did think Batman and.
I thought so. Robin Ince. Or was it neither of those?
It was
Robin.
It was R-O-B-Y-N.
Yeah.
Mm.
Isn't it Robin Thicke?
Robin Thicke.
Robin Thicke is a popular musician, opposite end innovation-wise. Possibly considered a de-innovator. She threw pop music forward 5 years, and then he actually was a useful corrective to set it back.
Nice.
Unovator.
Yeah, he was an unovator. He's sort of the equivalent of the barbarian horde smashing up Rome.
Like, but that's... I thought, isn't it on first name terms with Robin Thicke? Is this likely? Can't be.
Ince makes more sense, because I am on first name terms with Robin Ince.
That's what I thought.
Thicke and I'm going to amaze you here. We've never crossed paths.
I was looking at some superstitious comedians.
So
I looked at Hilda Baker, who was a Bolton comedian from the 1950s. And she considered the color green to be so bad luck that no one was allowed to wear green in the whole theater. But apparently this is quite a common thing, or it certainly was in the mid 20th century. And the reason is that Molière, who died on stage during the Hypochondriac, was apparently wearing green when he died on stage. Really? I've never heard this before.
That's also why, because Tommy Cooper, of course, died on stage wearing that square red hat with the black tassels, the fez, and no one wears that anymore.
I didn't know Molière Tommy Cooper'd.
That's
incredible.
They didn't call it that back then.
In the Hypochondriac as well. Yeah. So he was like,
Was he playing the title role?
Oh my God.
So people thought it was part of the...
And would he be coming off, you know, in between scenes saying, I'm really not feeling well? And they're saying, I know, of course.
He's Daniel Day-Lewis in it. Of course, we don't call it that now.
But that was the thing with Tommy Cooper, right? Yeah. He collapsed and people thought it was a bit.
Yeah.
Are you superstitious, Nish, about any aspect of a show?
I'm trying to think about sort of pre-show rituals. The most important thing that I always do is I always piss before I go. Yeah. Like, I'm obsessed. Even if I don't need it, I'll try and force one out. And I think part of it is because I read this thing. Apparently David Cameron used to give speeches on a slightly full bladder. Because there's some idea that Cameron
that's an episode of Friends as well.
Oh, is it?
Isn't yes,
it?
Joey gets a role where he really needs, and they're just so impressed by his urgency.
His urgency, because he needs to pee. Yeah.
And then he starts doing it for every role.
Apparently, having to pee makes me a really good actor.
So David Cameron's the same.
But then I also read that he got that Hitler used to do that as well. And I think I don't know whether any of that's correct. But when I read that, I thought, well. I want to be like Hitler or Cameron. I'm going to make sure I speak with the emptiest bladder possible in front of an audience.
You know what? I always have a wee before I go on stage as well. But I do the wee and I sit down when I'm doing the wee.
Yeah.
And then I sit down for another 20 seconds and then usually a little bit more comes out. And I got that tip from Sandy Toksvig, who got it apparently from Princess Anne.
What?
And I thought, I want to be like Sandy Toksvig and Princess Anne.
So that's you mean there's always more pee?
According to Princess Anne.
Yeah. Wow. Just holding back.
Princess Anne, you got a UTI, girl. that's fascinating.
I'm so disappointed that when you said I always pee before going on stage because David Cameron, I was just desperate for it to be that David Cameron once went on stage
and pissed himself, like A Star Is Born. Yeah. Just a really dark Tory party conference. just after the EU referendum, after he walked out of Downing Street, announced the result and quit, he just immediately pissed himself. He was wearing dark trousers so nobody noticed.
That conference where they all stood really legs
power
apart.
Pose, yeah.
That's what he was doing, just shaking it out.
Oh, God.
On comedians' superstitions, Carol Burnett, first woman ever to host a variety show, I think. She, at the end of every show for her whole life, did a little ear tug. She's 93, so I shouldn't act like she's dead. Little ear tug at the end of every show. Do you know why she did that?
Why?
When she went to do her first show, which was the Paul Winchell and Jerry Mahoney's show in December 1955. She was 22 years old. She was playing the girlfriend of a puppet. And her, she told her grandma, her nanny, she was like, I'm going to be on telly. And her nanny said, oh, say hello to me, will you? And she said, I can't really do that on TV, but I'll give you a little sign, this, on my ear. Wow. And forevermore. And she said, it just means, she said at first it meant, nanny, I'm here and I love you. And then later it meant, nanny, I'm here and I love you and your check's in the mail.
Oh, that's so nice.
Cool. Yeah.
That's really nice. Pavarotti?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Funny
guy.
Really good comedian. It's a shame because it's on the undercard of his career, but he was a funny dude.
He was very superstitious, and he wanted to find a bent nail before a performance backstage. Right. And he believed that if he found one, that's really good luck. And it's a theatre, so there are, you know, there's carpentry going on. There's often a nail around the stage, but his iron would frequently just leave nails strewn around so that Pavarotti would find one
just
before
quite
a gig
quickly,
and therefore have a great show.
I think that's probably the kind of stuff my tour manager does without me really fully understanding it. Yeah. I think there's a lot of unseen work being done by the people around me to get to sort of get me on stage.
Harold Lloyd.
Oh, yeah.
Very superstitious. He had a nice big house near Hollywood, and there was an ornamental fountain outside of it, and he thought it was extremely bad luck to drive around the fountain.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And so he never did it at any time in his life, and the only time he ever did it was the hearse on the way to the funeral. Okay. And
wait,
the interesting
his own funeral.
And yes, exactly. And the interesting thing about this is his house after he died became like a filming location. And in The Godfather, Westworld, Beverly Hills Cop, and Commando, someone drives around that fountain and then later in the movie suffers a horrible, horrific death.
No.
Yeah, have they written that
in? They've written it in.
Oh, wow.
That's very nice.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, isn't that good?
That's nicer than what we all thought, which was that just someone had a horrific death.
Yeah.
Okay, it's time for fact number three, and that's Andy.
My fact is, when David Bowie auditioned for the BBC in 1965, the judges ruled that he was a singer devoid of personality, that his band was not particularly exciting, and that there is no entertainment in anything they do.
There is no entertainment in anything they do.
It's unambiguous. You know, this guy's going nowhere.
It's not your shit, is it? It's like really putting and...
Yeah, it's much more scientific. So this was a thing that existed. It was called the Talent Selection Group. And it was a BBC institution that pulled together various radio producers.
Right.
To just assess everyone who wanted, you know, to be played on BBC radio.
Right, yeah.
So...
was he in 65?
Very young.
Yeah,
very young.
He was 69 when he died in 2016, and I'm now struggling to do the basic mathematics.
So he would have been 17 or 18.
Wow.
So he was very young and playing with a band, and the band was called David Bowie and the Lower Third. And it doesn't sound like it was a good audition. I mean, you know, I don't think it's too...
I mean, when you're 18...
Like, exactly.
I can see the picture of him. He must have been playing the sax and singing, I think, possibly.
Well, they did three songs because that's what you brought to the talent selection group. One of them was by Bowie himself. One of them was by James Brown. The third one was Chim Chimmery from Mary Poppins, which is a rogue choice.
Mm, that makes 100% sense to me. Like, if you think about his music, it is music that exists at the intersection between James Brown and Mary Poppins. Like, actually think about it. If you really think about it, there is like this interesting combination of Black American music and English whimsy. And actually there is something of both of those in Ziggy Stardust.
Well, if you'd been on the talent selection group, maybe it would have gone differently. But it did not. Another verdict, I don't think the group will get better with more rehearsal. Just devastating, you know.
That's one of the most withering things I've ever heard.
They can give them all the time of the world. They're not going to change, you know. Terrible.
That was terrible and you've peaked.
Brilliant.
It's a bit like Simon Cowell, isn't it? Would you say? Like, kind of slightly withering sort of...
Yeah. And I don't think it was Big Dogs. I just think it was random producers from across the beeb who were pulled in to, you know, assess.
Right.
And they assessed a load of different acts. They came up with various quite ropey judgments on acts who went on to be huge.
Yeah.
But it's an audition. It's at the very start of your career. They don't all go well, you know.
Yeah, and he took ages to get successful. I hadn't realised. I think by 1969, so before he was at all famous, he'd already been in seven bands, many of which he founded. Then 1969, Space Oddity was rushed out to coincide with the moon landings and was like the theme tune for that and was huge. But then he disappeared again.
Yeah.
And I don't think he had another hit for about 4 years. Yeah.
No, he didn't disappear. He just simply moved. He was living in Bromley.
Oh, yes.
Which is essentially the
potato
same
potato
thing. Sorry, he was in Beckenham at that point. But yeah, he was sort of that period of his life where after he turns 18, he kind of gets very fixated on this like mime teacher who is like a really, really influential person in his life. But also, it's worth seeking out some of the kind of first album, which I think is self-titled, or maybe it's called Space Oddity.
It is. It's David Bowie.
Yeah, it is David Bowie. Yeah. That, it's worth checking out that era of it because it is not... I say this as a very, very big fan of his.
You've hidden it well.
Yeah. Sorry. Sorry.
Beckenham. Yeah. No, Bromley. Well, of course, Beckenham is in Bromley. So
yeah. It's bad.
Oh, wow.
It's sort of... Bowie at this point is... He sort of goes through so many different iterations. Mm. And he falls in with... He goes, studies at mime school. Then the first album is sort of very, like, flower powery, like, tail end of Summer of Love hippie stuff. But then the shift between that and The Man Who Sold the World is extraordinary, right? It is an incredible transition. He basically really gets into the Velvet Underground. And that is the thing that kind of unlocks...
He's just trying all sorts of things. Yeah. He's trying so much out.
Yeah.
Can I just say one thing on the mime thing? Because I found out a little about this. This is insane. So he falls in with this mime artist called Lindsay Kemp, right?
That's it,
and becomes so entranced that Bowie nearly abandons music for interpretive dance.
Yeah.
When he was, again, not very famous yet, he opened for T-Rex. He supported them on, you know, tour as a one-man mime act depicting China's invasion of Tibet.
Brilliant.
And that is a challenge. That's a challenge, right? As a one man.
Yeah.
It's my favourite. It's
hard enough that there are a few of you.
You've got to think outside the tiny invisible box.
Basically, the T-Rex audience hated it for two reasons. One, come on, we're here to see T-Rex. And secondly, a lot of them were communists and very thrown out. So... This was a few months before Space Oddity came out. He later wrote to John Peel, who'd seen this, said, "You decided the problem was that I was doing mime. You didn't like mime. And until I came here to America, I never realized that you were right. Nobody in the world likes mime."
It is an insane period. And listen, thank God that doesn't exist, because I imagine it doesn't now look high art. It looks like Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. I imagine. But weirdly, that's, you know, Lindsay Kemp was a huge influence on him creatively, and they were lovers at the time. When you look at things like Ziggy, when you look at the video for Ashes to Ashes, even though that was sort of because he was also falling in with the New Romantics in the early 80s, you still see the influence of theatre and mime.
Oh yeah,
and
definitely.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we loved him anyway, but also it was really exciting because I went to school in Orpington, down the road from the school he went to, but he lived in Beckenham, and they tried to get him to come back. Like in the early 2000s, he was like, absolutely not. When he went to America in interviews, he would refer to things as being so Croydon if they were bad. But he was, that's why, you know, like The Buddha of Suburbia, the whole novel is really about growing up in Beckenham and Bromley and feeling depressed until you realise David Bowie lived there. how that unlocks the protagonist's creativity and sexuality. And
I was the same with Hilda Baker, the Bolton comedian from the 1950s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, like everyone from Bolton.
You've only just started wearing green now.
One of the formative moments of his life came from that time in Beckenham / Bromley, where he's famously, his eyes sort of look like the different colours, don't they? And this has actually put me off him a bit. And I messaged Dan Schreiber. Cruel, we're doing a podcast about David Bowie, who Dan Schreiber absolutely loves, but saying, I don't really like him. And I think it came from this. When he was 15, he had best friend George. They both fancied the same girl. Ooh. And George got a date with her. And Bowie called George and said, listen, I've spoken to her and she doesn't want to go out with you, actually, but she didn't want to say to your face. So George doesn't show up, then finds out Bowie's tricked him, and then goes into school next day and Bowie's boasting about how he's now going out with this girl. So George, quite right, goes and clocks him in the face in the playground, damages his eyeball. Said he did, really didn't mean to hurt him, but well, right. meant to hurt him a bit.
funny way of going about it. I meant to hurt him emotionally when I punched him in the face. Yeah,
didn't mean to cause him permanent damage. Yeah, but it gave him this condition called anisocoria, where one pupil is larger than the other, so his eyes aren't different colours. It's just one pupil's small, so it looks like his eyes are light coloured. And I really like this from an interview with a magazine. I think someone had written into the magazine with questions for Bowie, and one of the people said, "Hey, what would you say to that kid at school who punched you in the eye in case he's reading?" And Bowie said, "I'd probably say something along the lines of, it was great seeing you last week, George. Did I leave my lighter in your car?" Because they remain very close friends.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's good.
So you said that he almost gave up to be a mime.
Yeah.
He also almost gave up to be a Buddhist monk, didn't he?
Did he?
Yeah. And that's because he got in with some Buddhist monks in London, but also he read a book, The Rampa Story by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, who Andy remembers as a friend of the podcast. Mm-hmm.
He's a big deal.
He is a big deal.
Because he was not a Buddhist monk.
He was in no way a Buddhist monk. He was a plumber from Devon who pretended to be a Buddhist monk and wrote about this, about his life as a Tibetan monk, until people kind of came to his shows and said, "Can you read this thing that's in Tibetan?"
Yeah.
He said, "I can't really read Tibetan and I've never been to Tibet."
And
he said, "Oh, it's not my fault. I was possessed by the spirit of a monk when I fell out of a tree trying to photograph an owl."
That's right. That's right.
And then they said, "Yeah, that's not true, is it either?" And he went, "Oh, no, fine. Actually, it was all dictated to me by a Siamese cat called Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers."
Yes.
But the point is that a lot of the Buddhist sort of things that was happening in the time and everyone getting into Buddhism was down to this guy's book, and he was
completely nothing to do with Buddhism. That's amazing.
Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers, the cat, later wrote, I think, two of her own books through Tuesday Lobsang Rampa. And one of them is called Living with the Lama.
Yeah.
That's true.
Hell.
Yeah.
It's hard when a cat writes a book called Living with the Lama, because I think you do have to clarify in brackets afterwards that you mean the Lama as in religious Lama.
You can do a lot with the cover art.
I'm afraid you are not getting away with a James Cameron black square on that one. It's essential that we clarify with the cover
art. That's so funny. I didn't know there was a Bowie Rampa highway of understanding. That's amazing.
So what you big Bowie fans, what's the view on the whole Thin White Duke, quite intense flirtation with fascism, Nazism, that kind of stuff?
One word for the Nazi stuff. Your friend of mine. Cocaine. If you watch the Alan Yentob documentary Cracked Actor, which is his US tour, I think in 76, you can't believe he didn't immediately drop dead.
Yeah.
He was
in a bad way.
The rumor is at the time that he was subsisting exclusively on a diet of cocaine and milk. But he's coped himself into a psychosis.
Yeah.
There's a bit in it where he just starts going, they're following me. And he is
oh wow.
He is truly in a kind of psychosis. And I think people want to intellectualize it and say, well, he had this fascination with it. It's not any of that.
He did read a lot of books.
He did read a lot of books
about the Nazis.
But I think people want to talk about it as a kind of intellectual, like an extension of his interest in character and performance. He was gacked out of his mind. And I don't mean your friend who's standing too close to you at a party and asking if everyone hates him. I mean, he was seeing things. He was like, David Bowie was such an extreme party animal that he had to go to Berlin to clean up.
Yes.
Right. He had to go to Berlin to get drugs out of his system. That's how many drugs he had in his system at that point.
Can I just say, reading lots of books about Hitler and the Nazis is not actually a sign of anything. That's just a sign of being a middle-aged man, all right? I'm currently ploughing through The Last Days of Hitler and it's terrific.
That's it, really.
Yeah, no spoilers, please.
I saw him on the last tour he did in 2004, and he had something like a kind of heart valve problem about 2 months later, and then he never toured again. And he sort of would make like these intermittent public appearances. But I went on my own. This was in a period where I was going on my own to see a lot of gigs. And I saw him and James Brown in kind of quite quick succession.
Oh, and Mary Poppins, I hope.
And Mary Poppins. Yeah, yeah. And the David Bowie gig is the only time someone asked me if I was lost and needed help.
Wow. Oh, wow, the only time.
Are you okay? Are you lost? And I was like, no, I'm here to see David Bowie. And I've always carried resentment towards a man who was sat two rows in front of me wearing a Lou Reed Transformer t-shirt. And I, at the time, I remain a big Lou Reed fan, but I was really a big fan of the Lou Reed album Transformer at the time. And Bowie said, we're going to do a song by the Velvet Underground. And I cheered. Bear in mind, I'm at this gig on my own. Mm. And I assumed the man in the Lou Reed t-shirt would also cheer. And he didn't. And I was like, you're a fan of only Lou Reed's solo output? You've got no time for White Light, White Heat?
Maybe he's not just not a cheerer, you know?
Well, he made me look like an absolute twerp.
I would say, the smallest grudge I've ever heard carried for the longest time. Because of how long
it's
you've kept 22 something.
22 years. I still think about that guy and I'm like, that guy in the Lou Reed t-shirt.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
We should move on to our final fact of the show, and that is James's fact.
Okay, my fact this week is that the Swedish political party called the Center Party and the Danish political party called Left are both right-wing.
Are they trying to just nab sneaky votes on the ballot paper, people who haven't heard of them?
No, not really. So I was reading an article on electoralreform.org.uk, and it was a list of badly named parties. And basically, these parties all started off kind of left of centre 100-150 years ago, and things change. Like, the Democrats and Republicans have swapped over a couple of times, I think, of what they believe, right? Yeah. And also the what's that window called?
Overton.
The Overton window moved, so people who were a little bit left-wing or a bit right-wing are now more centrist or whatever. Yeah. And that's what's happened with these two parties, which is the Swedish Centre Party and Venstre, which is the Danish for left. And the Danish one is the main right of centre party and has been for 25 years.
Wow.
And the centre party, it depends on their leaders because they are a little bit centrist, but at the moment they're more right-wing.
But you can't change the name. It's easier to change your opinions, I guess, because everyone knows what the party is. Everyone knows the
name.
Yeah,
they're not really tricking anyone because everyone knows, everyone in Denmark knows this party.
Yeah.
I like that you say it's easier to change your opinions. You're suggesting rather than change their names, they should just become left-wing.
I wasn't really suggesting anything. I hadn't finished that thought.
But it is a bit like if Krispy Kreme donuts were like, we're plumbers now, but we've got a really strong brand identity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You're like, well, you could just change it. No, Krispy Kreme it is. Listen, I will say, in terms of tailoring this podcast episode to your guest, this could not be more clearly my internet search history. Electoralreform.org, James Cameron's Wikipedia page, and a video of David Bowie talking about the internet.
Denmark also has the Radical Left Party, Radicale Venstre.
Okay. Where are they at?
They're on the left, but they're the least radical of all the left-wing parties.
Really?
Yeah.
Something with radical in its name. It's centrist.
So good.
It is the problem. And listen, I am painting with a broad brush here, and I understand there is more nuance to these things, but it is sort of the problem of talking about Scandinavian politics, because you're like, these guys are really right wing. They only believe in partially comprehensive state cover for. I think the thing that distinguishes them is there are parties that there are basically parties that are like, that are socialist socialists, and then there are parties that are nationalist socialists. Like there is some.
Yeah, wait, yeah. When you say nationalist socialist, that has.
Yeah, at least yeah, reading right, a few yeah. books at the bottom.
There's still some consensus around some economic principles,
right.
But I think there's more divergence around.
So we believe
that everyone gets a year's maternity or paternity leave, but we do also believe in invading power.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that it?
Yeah,
I
believe there's an element of that.
There's a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment among certain parts of Scandinavia. Hmm. So there's a guy called Rasmus Paludan, who's a former member of Venstre. He's probably the most famous right-wing politician in Denmark. And he's like burned Qurans and stuff like that. Right. But there's a group called Free Jazz Against Paladin that follows him around the country and plays jazz very loudly and very badly at all of his events.
Is jazz the right... I'm not saying they're doing it badly, but is jazz the right genre of music to... I suppose it's quite surprising, you know, it goes in new directions, which is quite useful.
Famously anti-communist jazz, wasn't it? It was pushed by America to kind of stop communists from liking communism.
Was that?
Well, and also the musicians themselves were not aware sometimes, genuinely not aware. Nina Simone died without ever knowing that she was a CIA asset. Yeah, that an African tour of hers. Oh, God.
What?
Guys, you've got to watch a movie called Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat is an incredible film about these American state-funded operations to send jazz musicians as kind of soft power missions around the world. It's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. It's
and they didn't know that they were being pawns.
They didn't know that where the money was coming from, but also, you know, a lot of these,
like, we've had another $300 million in the account. No one likes jazz. Yeah. what's the reasoning that it's with the CIA stop people liking communism?
Specifically in the African continent, sometimes there were cover operations for the sort of traveling State Department delegations that would go out with them. Uh-huh. But also a lot of these musicians did not have rights in their own country. Right. And there's some really heartbreaking stuff in the documentary about Louis Armstrong and the kind of disgust that he feels, because he does understand that he's being used as propaganda for a white government that is not giving him rights in his own country. It is really, really brilliant and sinister. And what was done to Lumumba in that country by Western governments in service of the mining companies, because they might have liberated these countries, but they did not take the huge mining companies out of those countries. Mm-hmm. And the cobalt in phones still comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And there are still Western countries that might not have colonized them in the conventional sense, but the large corporations that are exploiting these countries for their mineral resources are effectively financially colonizing them. And now this podcast has really taken the full Kumar turn.
Because it's an exciting ride.
But in the Soviet Union, the idea was that they had certain approved musicians and approved literature and approved all this kind of stuff. So if you shove in some jazz singers, some surrealist art, stuff like that, then people will start thinking in a non-communist way. That was the idea.
Sort of freedom. Yeah. Freedom. Yeah. Jackson Pollock, was he?
Yeah, he was.
They just wanted to get rid of him.
That was very interesting.
Some more weird names in politics. Have you guys heard, or have we ever talked about, the tiny Indian state of Meghalaya?
No.
Meghalaya. This place is extraordinary. So there's a weird trend for weird names there. Like loads of people there call their kids weird names. No one really knows where it came from. Just like people from this Indian state call their kids strange names, which means that people who run for political office often have weird names. So people who've run for political office there include Frankenstein Momin, Field Marshal Morpiang, as in first name Field, second name Marshal.
Great.
That's good.
Billy Kid Sangmar. And someone who's gained office there is Adolf Lou Hitler Rangsak Marak, who's an Indian politician of the National Congress Party. He was a minister in their government. He was asked if he felt awkward about it, and he said, "I am aware at one point in time Adolf Hitler was the most hated person on earth, but my father added Lou in between the Adolf and the Hitler, so that's why I am different."
Andy, you were very disappointed when you got his biography, weren't you?
A lot more regional Indian politics than I had really bargained for.
And the cover was just a black square. We really could have done with the clarification of some cover art there.
I think it's interesting how political parties arose in the first place. I think they were invented in Britain. Certainly in Britain, it was the Whigs and the Tories.
Yeah.
And that was the end of the 17th century. And it was all to do with the question of Catholic succession, which was a big deal for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very controversial. And the Whigs wanted it was about the Duke of York, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Should the Duke of York be in the line of succession?
And what do we think now?
It's a debate that rages on.
The Whigs are coming back going, "I told you!"
Yeah, Whigs wanted him out, and Tories were much more arch traditionalists, and they wanted to preserve the succession. But
so the what they were trying to conserve was the Catholic line of succession.
Yes, right. Yeah. I mean, it's maybe a bit upside down from what we think today.
Were they called the Tories? They were called the Tories and not the Conservatives at that time.
Tories was originally an insult. It's a kind of Irish bandit. And I think Whigs is also a kind of insult as well. Yeah, every party name starts off as an insult and then devolves into the actual name.
Poop party.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got to be careful the insults you embrace and the insults you cast aside. But yeah, and actually, because we were talking about Swedish politics, Sweden was dominated by the Hats and the Caps for about 100 years. They were the two parties, and the Caps was an insult. So the Hats were meant to be the like strong militaristic. They were named after the big tricorn hats that like proper posh people had, members of government and military. And then they said, "Are you cat, you nightcaps?" And they were referring to the this floppy like wee willy winky nightcaps.
Really? And did they wear them? Like, did they embrace it and wear them on the campaign?
I don't think they actually went into the trouble of sourcing nightcaps and embracing them, but they embraced their names, the Caps, and they were like they were the Whigs and the Tories.
Are they still worn? Would you say nightcaps?
Because I would obviously do wear one.
Well, I've got one, yeah. But I just want to know if anyone... I would be curious if anyone wears a nightcap.
People wear bonnets to help manage curly hair.
Yes, that's true.
Bonnets are still used.
Yeah.
Are they called nightcaps? I don't know. Were they bonnet wearers?
Normally known as bonnets, I believe, still.
Were they used to keep your head warm? Is that
I
the point of them?
So, yeah, because it's so much colder back in the day.
Yeah.
I would assume that it's...
The little ice age.
Yeah.
If you still wear a nightcap to bed, podcast@qi.com.
Absolutely.
Send Andy a picture.
Absolutely. If anyone's still wearing a nightcap, with love, they are listening to this podcast. Let's be honest. A big Ebenezer Scrooge number.
That's one I want. That's one I want. Yeah, yeah. Do you want to come on upstairs for a nightcap?
Just two people sat in hats, one of them looking confused and disappointed.
I'll get the warming pan. I do like a frivolous party.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a big fan of the occasional protest parties. One of them, I mean, the Wikipedia of frivolous political parties is terrific if you just want to read through. So many places that have frivolous parties, it's beer related. Very interesting. As the Friends of Beer Czech, Belarus Beer Lovers Party, Austria Beer Party, Australia Lower Excise Fuel and Beer Party. It just goes on. Germany, Norway, Poland, Romania, Ukraine. They've all got a beer lovers party or a beer party. Yeah.
There was definitely a light beer versus dark beer political rivalry as well, I think, in the Poland. Late 19th century. But I like in Denmark, the Union of Conscientiously Workshy Elements, which I don't think we've actually mentioned before, founded by Jacob Haugaard in 1979. And so they were demanding lots of mad stuff, and it was a complete joke, like better Christmas presents for everyone, Nutella for all army field rations, better weather, tailwinds on all bike paths.
Better weather.
It's Denmark. More Renaissance furniture in IKEA. Of course, you'd back it, Andy. But in 1994, he was elected. Haugaard was elected unexpectedly. Really didn't expect to be. Got 23,000 votes. And it was a hung parliament. So suddenly he was in this extraordinary position of having the deciding vote in a lot of situations.
So when the Lib Dems came in and did a coalition with the Tories, they said, well, we will do it if we can have one of our policies, which is proportional representation.
Yeah.
Which one did he go for?
They genuinely did introduce Nutella into army rations for a while.
Very good.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I think it doesn't exist anymore.
The Lib Dems didn't get PR over the line yet. No. So these guys are still technically one up on the Lib Dems.
Did they have a referendum about the Nutella
thing? It's an easier one to win, isn't it? He did say in a moment of foresight, he made a portrait of him. He got a portrait done of him and had it hung in Parliament. And he said he commissioned it to warn people that any crazy populist moron could get elected. And this was in the early 90s. So
we learned our lesson.
We learned it too late.
There was a survey this year of places in the North Caucasus, and they asked for people who you think would be a good person who your leader espouses their views. And a lot of people went for Stalin. In fact, I think Stalin might have been the top respondent. But 4% of people said that they wanted their leader to be like T-800 from the Terminator movie.
And we're back.
Wow.
And we're back.
And is that the baddie, or is this the second Terminator?
Well, this is the complicated thing.
Yeah, I mean,
he's the baddie in the first one and the goodie in the second one. He gets reprogrammed, and he goes from being a baddie to a
goodie. He's like Nick Clegg.
Right. And I see, but the reverse.
Reverse Clegg. It's the old reverse Clegg. In the first one, he's trying to get people to go into the metaverse. And in the second one, he's promising to get rid of student debt. The old reverse Cleggy.
Okay, we should wrap up on that. Thank you so much for listening. We have been No Such Thing as a Fish, and thank you to my co-podcasters, James Harkin, Andrew Hunter-Murray, and Nish Kumar. Nish Kumar, if people want to contact you, where can they do it?
Contact me.
You can find me at nishkumar.co.uk, and I'm Mr. Nish Kumar on Instagram and some other platforms, I think. But you can watch me doing 97 minutes of stand-up, if that's something that you'd be interested in on YouTube, or you can buy tickets for my tour, or you can do both. No Such Thing as a Niche. Thank you.
Lovely stuff. And Andy and James, you also have social media profiles, which we've mentioned lots of times before, so I'm sure you all know them. And you can contact the podcast by emailing podcast@qi.com or go to @nosuchthing on Instagram. And if you want access to our secret special club, which has lots of extra content, we release our Duel, which is our listener feedback episodes on there, and other exciting things as they come along. Just go to patreon.com/clubfish to find out more about that. But for now, we will see you again next week. Goodbye.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.